content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We are reading this week from the December 18th, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. As you might expect, there are a number of stories this week about the act of terror in California. I'm actually going to skip the main story because there's an in-depth one in The Last Word and cover that. So, the main story we'll take today is outrage over Trump's Muslim ban. What happened? Donald Trump set off a new shockwaves in the presidential campaign this week, calling for a total and complete ban on Muslims entering the U.S. in the wake of the terrorist attack in San Bernardino, California. "We had no choice," the Republican presidential frontrunner told a cheering crowd in Charleston, South Carolina, adding that polls showed Muslims have a hatred for Americans that is beyond comprehension. The proposal inspired rare bipartisan consensus, drawing condemnation across the political spectrum. White House spokesman John Earnest said Trump's singling out of Muslims for discrimination disqualifies him from serving as president. Trump also denounced by many of his Republican rivals and GOP leaders, who largely held their fire throughout his previous proposals to round up and deport all illegal immigrants and create a national registry of Muslims. Jeb Bush declared Trump unhinged, and former Vice President Dick Cheney said, "To ban a whole religion goes against everything we stand for." In Europe and the Muslim world, Trump's proposal sparked outrage. Dar al-Ifta, Egypt's official religious body, called his rhetoric hate speech, while British Prime Minister David Cameron deemed it divisive, unhelpful, and quite simply wrong. The billionaire was unbowed, however, and warned that if the GOP gangs up on him, he might mount an independent bid. Trump cited a new USA Today Suffolk University poll that indicates that 68% of my supporters would vote for me if I ran as an independent. What the editorial said: "It's time for Republicans to renounce Donald Trump's candidacy," said the Washington Post. Heartening, though, it is to see GOP leaders condemn his lunatic and offensive rants. They should make clear they would oppose him if he were the party's nominee. Trump can no longer be dismissed as an entertaining circus act. Republicans have to wake up and recognize that a Trump presidency would fracture American society along racial, ethnic, and religious lines. Expressions of dismay are not enough. It is time to say clearly he is anathema to the Republican Party and to the nation. President Obama's failure to confront global jihad left an opening for Donald Trump's unfiltered nationalist id, said the Wall Street Journal. Obviously, Trump's ideas are odious and unconstitutional, but he shrewdly calculates that they will resonate with a public feeling jittery under a commander-in-chief who said ISIS was contained on the eve of the Paris attacks, and that the U.S. homeland was safe shortly before San Bernardino. Trump's rhetoric and his rise proves an old political truism that demagogues flourish in the absence of leadership. What the columnist said: Trump's rhetorical excesses aside, his proposal should trigger a much-needed discussion about Muslim immigration, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. While many Muslims assimilate into the Western tradition of personal and religious liberty, some reject our traditions and cling to Sharia law. the authoritarian Islamic legal code that is counter-constitutional in its most basic elements, and at worst endorses violent jihad. For these Muslims, Islam is no mere religion, but a political program with a religious veneer that threatens our security. Trump's Muslim ban is actually about Ted Cruz, said Margaret Hartman in NYMag.com. It's no coincidence that he took his Islamophobia to the next level soon after a Monmouth University poll showed Cruz surging past him into first place among Iowa Republicans. So Trump generated yet another of the headline-making controversies that invariably stoke his numbers. It's brilliant politics, said Eric Erickson in RedState.com. The day after Obama failed to reassure a scared public, Trump snookered all the other candidates except Cruz, who offered only tepid disagreement, into aligning themselves with the president. In a Republican primary, that's fatal. Trump has become a clear and present danger for the GOP, said Chris Saliza in the Washington Post. After losing the 2008 and 2012 presidential elections, the party urgently needs to realign itself with non-white voters, the Mexicans, Muslims, and others being insulted by Trump. Yet there's not a damn thing the party can do to rein in the billionaire. It can't limit his bankroll or media exposure, or criticize him harshly in case he makes an independent run and takes his supporters with him. I asked one GOP strategist how Republicans could disarm Trump, given the party's lack of leverage. His answer? Pray. While we're on this page, we'll pick up a short from the It Wasn't All Bad section. Elvira Montez is a champion. Last week, the 81-year-old grandmother competed with her family in Austin's Flow Track Beer Mile World Championships, in which runners have to chug a 12-ounce beer before each of the four quarter-mile laps. Montez, who's been running since she was 60, finished in 20 minutes, 24 seconds, 50 seconds faster than her 47-year-old daughter. Her son-in-law couldn't even make it to the finish line. The octogenarian says she doesn't even like beer, preferring scotch instead. I tried to drink the first one really fast, but I couldn't, she said. The second one went down really smooth. The third, even better. The fourth was all right. Our controversy of the week. San Bernardino, when terrorists can buy assault weapons. The San Bernardino terrorist attack should have been a unifying moment in the gun debate rather than a polarizing one, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. When Syed Farouk and Tashfeen Malik stormed an office Christmas party last week armed with two AR-15 semi-automatic rifles, two semi-automatic pistols, and 1,600 rounds of ammunition, they killed 14 people and wounded 21 more, topping off one of the worst years for mass shootings in modern U.S. history. There have been more than 350 shootings this year in which four or more people were killed or injured, and all of those massacres, whether motivated by mental illness, racism, hatred of Planned Parenthood, or ISIS-inspired terrorism, were made possible by our lax gun and lax gun laws. And yet Republicans continue to oppose the most minimal and practical of gun reforms, such as universal background checks and the no-buy list proposed by congressional Democrats, said David Wheeler in CNN.com. That legislation would ban suspected terrorists on the no-fly list from buying a gun. If we can't close a loophole that allows known and suspected terrorists to legally purchase guns, what does that say about us? First off, France is one big gun-free zone, said Katie Pavlich in TheHill.com. and that didn't stop Kalashnikov-wielding terrorists from slaughtering 130 people in Paris last month. And while the no-fly list sounds like a register of dangerous individuals, it's actually a bureaucratic mishmash of 47,000 people, including thousands who have no links to terrorism at all, but simply have names similar to those of suspected terrorists. That's hardly a basis to take away someone's constitutional right to buy firearms. The no-buy list wouldn't have stopped Malik and Farouk from getting a gun anyway, said Philip Bump in the Washington Post. Neither was on the no-fly list, and they obtained their weapons legally, despite California having some of the strictest gun laws in the nation. One reason that no clear, implementable policy solutions have been proposed might be that none yet exist. No gun law can stop all mass shootings, but banning assault weapons would surely reduce the carnage, said Scott Martell in LATimes.com. Assault weapons, like the ones used by Malik and Farouk, are designed to kill large numbers of people in a short period of time, especially when equipped with large-capacity magazines, allowing shooters to pump out 30 or more bullets without reloading. These kinds of weapons have been deployed in many high-casualty mass shootings, including those at the Sandy Hook Elementary School and the movie theater killings in Aurora, Colorado. That's a red herring, said NationalReview.com in an editorial. Rifles of any kind are used in a vanishingly small share of U.S. murders, 3%. Crushing ISIS would go much further to prevent further massacres than confiscating guns from law-abiding citizens who like to shoot quail or keep a scary-looking gun in the basement, just in case. If the gun lobby were honest, said Adam Gopnik in The New Yorker, they'd say regular mass killings of innocents are a price worth paying for the right to own whatever weapons we want. Thanks to that belief, we have been running an experiment of a kind that no sane ethicist would allow. What happens when, in a country large enough to contain every imaginable kind of crazy, from the inward-turning maniac sort to the outward-turning politicized kind, you make sure that almost anyone can readily buy any kind of gun? The answer, you get more massacres than there are days in the year. It was a good week for channeling the Force. After an Austin movie theater announced a Star Wars viewing endurance contest in which fans will compete to stay awake the longest during a nonstop marathon of the 7-part film saga. No artificial stimulants allowed. It was a good week for getting a fake tree after a prolonged drought in the Pacific Northwest severely limited the supply of Christmas trees, causing a steep price spike. Health officials also warned that a lack of sub-freezing weather in many northern climates this year may leave some trees infested with disease-causing ticks. It was a good week for keeping an eye on your luggage after a French aircraft maker, Zodiac Aerospace, announced plans to build planes with passenger seating inside the cargo hold. Lower-tier seats will be equipped with video screens so that passengers can glimpse what they would be seeing out the missing windows. But it was a bad week for hot holiday gifts. After consumer safety officials in the UK revealed that 88% of the 17,000 hoverboards they tested had a high risk of exploding or catching fire. There have been reports of fires and explosions of the self-balancing scooters in the U.S. It was a bad week for being a master of your own domain. After the website JebBush.com was found to automatically redirect users to DonaldJTrump.com, the GOP frontrunner's official campaign page. And it was a bad week for kitties. After a Norwegian newspaper published an obituary for Santa Claus, stating that the jolly old elf had recently died at the age of 226. The obituary was an internal joke that should never have been published, the newspaper said in an apology. On the briefing page this week, the ultimate blackout. A powerful electromagnetic pulse could knock out the power grid and the internet. How serious is the threat? What is an electromagnetic pulse? It's a powerful burst of electromagnetic energy with enormous destructive potential. An EMP can arise from natural phenomena, such as lightning strikes, or from human activity, such as a nuclear explosion. What makes EMPs ominous is their potential to wreak havoc with a world that is now utterly dependent on electrical technology. If strong enough, the storm of electrons and other charged particles from an EMP could disrupt the Earth's magnetic field, disable satellites and the internet, ground all commercial aviation, silence telecommunications, and fry much of the electrical grid, catapulting our society back to the 19th century for months or years. Peter Pry, executive director of the Federal EMP Task Force on National and Homeland Security, told Congress this week that a major EMP could cause widespread starvation, disease, and societal collapse that could lead to the deaths of tens of millions of people. The Obama administration recently released a multi-agency battle plan to study and defend against what many scientists consider the most likely source of EMPs, solar storms, which Bill Murtaugh of the White House Official Office of Science and Technology Police calls a real and present danger. What are solar storms? Huge eruptions of magnetically charged plasma from the sun's roiling interior, which explode outward into space. Also known as coronal mass ejections, moderate solar storms occur fairly regularly and harmlessly, sometimes causing spectacular auroras that illuminate the sky over the North and South Poles. But even typically benign solar storms generate energy that dwarfs our planet's entire nuclear arsenal, said astronomer Phil Plait. And what of a massive event? People sometimes ask me if anything in astronomy actually worries me, says Plait. Something like this is near the top of that list, with good reason. Experts say there is a 12% chance that a monster solar storm will strike Earth within the next decade. A National Academy of Science study concluded that a storm of that scope could cause $2 trillion of damage in the first year of recovery alone, 20 times the cost of Hurricane Katrina. Has such a storm ever hit Earth? Yes, several times. The last one, dubbed the Carrington event, hit in 1859. A far smaller solar flare in 1989 sent a pulse of radiation that left 6 million people in Quebec without power for up to 9 hours. Much more alarming was a solar superstorm that barely missed Earth in July 2012. Astronomers say the sun spewed out a huge magnetic cloud that tracked straight through our planet's orbit. Fortunately, for civilization, Earth was elsewhere in its path around the sun at the time. But had the storm roared through 9 days earlier, a worst-case scenario could have occurred. Satellites involved in crucial global communications, including GPS, would have been ruined. Large electrical transformers would have been destroyed, and ATMs would have stopped functioning. The internet would have been disabled on a massive scale. Most people wouldn't even have been able to flush toilets, which rely on electric pumps. 3 years later, we would still be picking up the pieces, says astronomer Daniel Baker. What about man-made EMPs? It's possible that terrorists or rogue states could detonate a nuclear weapon in the atmosphere and generate a paralyzing EMP. In 2001, Congress established an EMP commission, which recommended a combination of intelligence gathering, disaster relief planning, and research to brace for an attack. Former CIA Director James Woolsey last year told the House Armed Services Committee that two-thirds of the U.S. population would likely perish over a period of years. But many analysts doubt that an EMP attack on the U.S. by, say, North Korea is likely, since it would be taken as an act of war and invite a devastating nuclear response. If a country or terrorist group were going to attack the U.S. with nuclear weapons, most analysts think, they would choose to cause more direct and immediate damage by targeting Washington, New York, or other population centers. What protective measures are possible? The Obama administration has taken steps to replace some aging satellites that monitor space weather and extra high voltage transformers that are vulnerable to solar storms. Its new plan also calls for scientists to establish benchmarks for weather events in space, incorporating something like the Richter scale. We have to understand how big these storms can be to know what to protect against, says Murtaugh. The strategy also includes assessing the vulnerability of the power grid, increasing international cooperation, and improving solar flare forecast technology, a crucial step. But Pry, chairman of the EMP Commission, says neither the White House nor Congress is taking the threat seriously enough or acting with appropriate urgency. It would cost about $2 billion, the amount of foreign aid we give to Pakistan, to harden the nation's power grid to minimize the damage from either a nuclear EMP or a solar flare, he says. If we suspended that aid for 1 year and put it toward hardening the electrical grid, Price says, we could protect the American people from this threat. The Great Solar Storm of 1859. On September 1, 1859, British astronomer Richard Carrington noticed a brilliant solar flare over England. In the days that followed, a succession of coronal mass ejections struck Earth head-on. Auroras illuminated night skies from Africa to Hawaii. The light appeared to cover the whole firmament, one Baltimore newspaper reported. It had an indescribable softness and delicacy. The effects were more than aesthetic. EMPs from the storm caused telegraph systems, the Victorian Internet, to fail throughout North America and Europe. In some cases, lines sparked and offices caught fire. Otherwise, the damage was minimal. After all, that was long before humanity became utterly reliant on electronics. And it was when history repeated itself as it was when history repeated itself 153 years later. The July 2012 storm was in all respects at least as strong as the Carrington event, says astronomer Daniel Baker. The only difference is it missed. And we will look at a few of the columns now. We'll start with one from the U.S. titled, Look Who Isn't Coming to Dinner. In 1960, only 5% of Republicans and 4% of Democrats said they would be upset if their son or daughter married someone affiliated with the other political party. 5 decades later, 49% of Republicans and 33% of Democrats said they'd be distressed by a politically mixed marriage. It's just one more piece of mounting evidence, said Ezra Klein and Alvin Chang, that American partisanship is mutating into a form of political identity that reaches into almost every aspect of our lives. In study after study, political scientists are finding that Republicans and Democrats view each other with a growing disdain that borders on hatred. In one recent experiment, Democrats and Republicans showed instant, automatic, negative bias against people of the other party. More bias, in fact, than whites show against blacks and vice versa. It's the one form of bigotry that's still acceptable, with entire TV networks devoted to making Democrats or Republicans look stupid and dangerous. Partisanship now strongly influences our choice of friends, where we choose to live, what source of information we allow into our homes and devices, even who we love. This from Germany. We can't take in everybody. Chancellor Angela Merkel is backtracking on refugees, said Melanie Amann. In September, in a moment of unaccustomed conviction, she told the tens of thousands of refugees stranded in Hungary that they were welcome in Germany, that the right to asylum had no upper limit. 3 months later, though, it's becoming apparent that there will have to be a limit. Nearly 10,000 refugees are entering the country every day, and Merkel's coalition partners and cabinet members, whom she did not inform before issuing her blanket invitation, are rebelling. Interior Minister Thomas de Maizière has proposed stricter checks on refugees and limits on family reunification, and other cabinet members support his stance. So now, while Merkel is publicly sticking to her rhetoric, she is privately planning a new quota system that would effectively limit the number of people admitted to Germany next year. Her plan calls for the European Union to accept up to 500,000 of the 2 million mostly Syrian and Iraqi refugees now in Turkey. In turn, Turkey would pledge to stop allowing any other refugees to leave for Greece. But will Europe and Turkey go along? If Merkel's plan fails, she could be forced to do something she has always ruled out: close Germany's borders and turn away refugees. And this third column from South Africa, rebranding Mandela as a sellout. Just 2 years after his death, Nelson Mandela's heroic legacy is in jeopardy, said Ranjini Munusamy. Today's youth who grew up in post-apartheid South Africa are frustrated over continued white dominance of the economy and persistent poverty in the townships where most blacks live. They are starting to resent the compromises Mandela made during the transition period and question the concept of racial reconciliation that defined his presidency. Radical socialist leader Julius Malema, 34, who broke from Mandela's ruling African National Congress to form the Economic Freedom Fighters Party, has made himself into the spokesman for our frustrated youth. Last week, he crossed a line by openly criticizing Mandela on a trip abroad. In Oxford, Malema said that Mandela had promised to redistribute land and nationalize resources, but sold out to his rich white friends and didn't either. The Nelson we celebrate now is a staged managed Mandela who compromised the principles of the revolution, Malema said. To older ears, such a sentiment is blasphemy, but Malema is tapping into the growing anger of people stuck in a state of hopelessness. Mandela, once the embodiment of our liberation, is becoming a symbol of our decay and self-loathing. Time for our in-depth article, The Last Word, titled this week, Untangling a Couple's Radicalization. The San Bernardino killers hid in plain sight, said Toby Harden and John Harlow, while plotting a massacre. Spilt across their cluttered kitchen counter was the last meal enjoyed by Tashfeen Malik and her husband, Saeed Farouk. Along with orange juice and paratha bread were bottles of Adderall and Xanax pills, prescribed to steady the nerves. Unwashed dishes lay in the sink of the modest two-bedroom home at 53 North Center Street in Redlands, California. There were boxes of Pampers diapers and tins of Cerelac powder baby milk for their six-month-old daughter. On the living room table was a Quran, one of many religious books, including Common Mistakes Regarding Prayer, and a slim volume called Islamic Manners. Two sets of prayer beads lay on a bed. The drugs could have been much more than an aid to relieving the stress of a young newlyweds. She was 29, he was 28, coping with their first baby. They might help to explain how the devout Muslim couple could walk into a Christmas event linked to Farouk's work in nearby San Bernardino and calmly spray his colleagues with bullets, killing 14 and injuring 21. Most extraordinary of all was the fact that it was Malik who took the lead, opening fire before her husband. The couple's murderous spree took less than 4 minutes. Afterward, they walked slowly and deliberately out of the building and climbed back into their rented black Ford Expedition 4x4. Dressed in black and wearing tactical vests and magazines and with more than 1,600 rounds of ammunition in their pockets, they were still each carrying an AR-15-style assault rifle and 9mm pistol. Before they left, they tried to detonate a remote-controlled explosive device made of 3 pipe bombs in a bag. It failed to explode, probably because a stray bullet had activated the sprinkler system. Around the time of the attack, Malik used a war name on Facebook to pledge her loyalty to ISIS and its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. The couple then avoided the police for some 4 hours before staging a last stand and dying together in a hail of bullets. So were the perpetrators self-radicalized Islamists, or could they have been directed by ISIS or another group? Does the San Bernardino massacre represent an ominous new phase in the war with radical Islam? Or is it yet another isolated lone wolf attack? And who were the apparently ordinary husband and wife who deserted their baby daughter, now being looked after by social services, before committing an act of such unspeakable evil? Earlier on the day of the attack, at about 9:30 a.m., 80 of Farouk's fellow local government workers met in a conference room inside the Inland Regional Medical Center. Months before, many had chipped in for baby presents for Farouk, an environmental health inspector for 5 years, and his wife. Among those gathered was Farouk. Ready to be bored, one colleague joked with him. The event was a training session, to be followed by a party and lunch. At about 10:30, Farouk got up abruptly and left, leaving his jacket on the back of his chair. Some say he slipped out. Others say there had been a heated discussion with Nicholas Thalassinos, 52, who identified as a Messianic Jew and was a fervent supporter of Israel. Either way, it is now clear Farouk's departure was the precursor to a carefully planned attack carried out with devastating efficiency. Once Farouk was back at the house, the couple left their daughter with his mother, Rafia Farouk, 62, telling her they had a doctor's appointment to go to. They then went to the garage, which contained what the FBI described as a bomb factory and arsenal. More than 4,000 rounds of ammunition, a dozen pipe bombs, and scores of weapons and explosive components were later discovered there. At 11 a.m., less than 30 minutes after Farouk had left the center, he was back. The couple walked through the doors and took what witnesses described as a stance. She stood on the right of the door to the conference room. He was on the left as they pointed their long rifles at his astonished co-workers. Farouk appeared to hesitate, perhaps momentarily losing his nerve or maybe to seek out a specific victim, such as Thalassinos, with whom he had argued over whether Islam could call itself a peaceful religion. It was Malik who pulled the trigger first, aiming semi-automatic fire at people gathered around a Christmas tree, knocking it sideways. There was bedlam as people were shot and fell. Others screamed and cried as they sought cover. Middle managers who had been examining ways of helping autistic and other disabled children and their families dived under the tables covered with festive decorations. That is where many of them died. The luckier ones ran out the back door as Farouk strode forward, stepping over overturned tables and bleeding victims, and dumped the bag containing the explosive device on the same table he had been sitting at earlier. Rather than pursue the workers, Farouk and Malik left swiftly. What they did for the next 4 hours is unknown, but shortly after 3 p.m., police spotted the expedition driving close to North Center Street. They were traveling at a careful 15 miles per hour when San Bernardino police cruisers lit up sirens and began a pursuit. A bystander recorded the moment when Farouk, who was driving, accelerated sharply while Malik, crouching in the back seat with a rifle, opened fire at the police, shattering the back window. The couple hurled a fake pipe bomb into the path of the police cruisers and minutes later ground to a halt, the expedition already riddled with bullets. Farouk got out and was cut down by police bullets. Malik died inside the vehicle. Together they had fired 76 rounds, the police 380. Thalassinos was among the dead at the center. Also killed were Michael Wetzel, 37, a father of six, and Benetta Betbadal, 46, the wife of a police officer and a Christian who fled to America from Iran when she was 18 to escape Islamic extremism. Aurora Godoy, 26, the youngest killed, had a baby son. When Malik arrived at Chicago's O'Hare Airport on July 27th last year after a flight that originated in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, the FBI and U.S. Department of Homeland Security had already carried out extensive background checks on her. She had submitted her Pakistani passport and been fingerprinted, but no red flags had been raised, despite her family's originating from the city of Karor Lal Ehsan in Punjab province. Pakistan's Inner Services Intelligence Agency views Karor Lal Ehsan as a hotbed of support for jihadist groups, including Lashkar-e-Taiba. Javed Ravani, Malik's uncle, said that her father had become considerably more conservative after moving to Saudi Arabia. Although born in Pakistan, she had been raised in Jeddah. A friend from school there, Sabine Ahmed, described her as an average student who didn't particularly like Saudi Arabia's conservative culture. She returned to Pakistan to study, graduating in 2012 from Bahunadin Zakaria University in Multan, Punjab, with a degree in pharmacology. That period in Pakistan is key to the FBI's investigation. It was about that time during Malik's visits to the family in Karachi that they noticed signs of her radicalization. She turned religious 4 years back and started praying five times a day, said her cousin, Shaib Ahmed. She was extremely critical of Pakistan's policies toward fellow Muslims in Afghanistan and operations in Waziristan. One former CIA officer said Malik and Farouk's coolness under fire and ability to kill so many people so quickly indicated at least some degree of training, possibly in Pakistan. Intelligence sources have also suggested Malik might have been linked to the infamous Lal Masjid, or Red Mosque, in Islamabad, northeast of Karor Lal Ehsan. The mosque is revered among Pakistani extremists. It has named a library in honor of Osama bin Laden, and in 2014, its female madrasa students published a video praising ISIS leader Baghdadi. According to a close friend of Malik, who did not want to be named, the couple had been influenced by the preachings of Anwar al-Awlaki, an extremist imam killed by the U.S. drone strikes in Yemen in 2011. The FBI is now convinced that Malik was already radicalized by the time she arrived on U.S. soil. Far from being a young graduate pursuing love and the American dream, the FBI says, She was already intent on attacking the country from within when she married Farouk. Malik first met Farouk online. He had a profile on the dating website iMilap.com using the moniker Farouk Saeed 49. It stated he enjoyed working on vintage and modern cards, reads religious books, and enjoys eating out, as well as traveling and just hanging out in the backyard doing target practice. During most of the 17 months leading up to the attack, Malik lived with Farouk and his mother. She appears to have had no discernible online or social media presence. This remarkably low public presence could have simply befitted a devout Muslim woman. It might also have been an operational tactic designed to keep her profile low and avoid interest from authorities. 3 weeks after Malik's arrival, she and Farouk married at the Islamic Center Mosque of Riverside, 20 miles southwest of Redlands. That qualified her for a green card or permanent residence visa. She was in America to stay. Age 27 when she married, Malik was her husband's senior and on the older side for a Pakistani bride, and appears to have been the more dominant figure in their marriage. By contrast, Farouk, a U.S. citizen born in Chicago, was westernized. He graduated from California State University Fullerton with a degree in environmental engineering. For the past 5 years, Farouk had worked for the county health department, checking food surfaces at restaurants and chlorine levels in public swimming pools. Thin and about 6 feet tall, he was shy and rarely started a conversation, but was liked by colleagues. He was very religious, sometimes attending prayers at the Islamic Center Mosque as early as 4:30 a.m. and again in the evening. At Friday services, he wore traditional long robes. Christian Nwadik, who worked with Farouk for 5 years, noticed a change after his wedding. "I think he married a terrorist," he said. Neither Malik nor Farouk was being watched by the U.S. authorities, said FBI Director James Comey, said this week after Farouk was radicalized as far back as 2012 and made contact with at least five people connected to terrorism organizations. The FBI also said that Farouk and Malik discussed jihad and martyrdom online in 2013, even before they met in person and became engaged. Among items discovered in the house were miniature Christmas tree bulbs. An issue of Inspire, an Al-Qaeda magazine, included an article titled "Designing a Timed Hand Grenade with Instructions to Make a Delayed Igniter with Christmas Tree Bulbs." The FBI found evidence that in their final days, the couple tried to erase their electronic footprints, destroying devices. Two smashed mobile phones were discovered in a garbage bin near the home. Malik had what appeared to be a burner phone, one meant to be used for a short time and discarded, on her body. Nada Bekos, a former CIA analyst who specialized in tracking Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the forerunner of ISIS, said if it turned out that Malik had been the operational leader of the attack, it could be a game changer. "Radicalization and violence is not gender specific," said Bakos. "Women are entirely capable of it. She was in the perfect situation to be able to pull it off. She was here legally and not on anyone's radar." Back at North Center Street, Doyle Miller, 81, the couple's landlord, pondered Malik's role in the relationship as he surveyed the wreckage of his property after the FBI smashed down the door and ripped holes in the wall. "She did not like to be seen," he said. "She did not seem to like people around here. He seemed ordinary, no worries for me at all. I'm only now thinking that maybe she wore the pants. It could be that she was behind it all." This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Sunday Times, UK. going to take a one in the business columns this week. It's their issue of the week, a coal baron's conviction. The federal courthouse in Charleston, West Virginia, was the scene last week of a pitiful sort of justice, but historic nonetheless, said Zoe Carpenter in TheNation.com. Don Blankenship, the former CEO of Massey Energy, became the first ever American coal executive to be convicted of a crime related to mining deaths. For well over a decade, the man known as the King of Coal had the West Virginia coal industry in his pocket, along with a fair number of the state's judges. A micromanaging boss notorious for his relentless pursuit of profits, he crushed the coal miners' union and tripled Massey's revenue, demanding production reports every 30 minutes from his mountaintop villa, even as his company ignored hundreds of safety violations. Then, in April 2010, an explosion ripped through Massey's Upper Big Branch mine, killing 29 workers. It was the worst mining disaster in four decades, so bad that even the King of Coal couldn't fully get away with it. And yet, in a substantial defeat for the Justice Department, jurors acquitted Blankenship of the most serious felony charges he faced, said Alan Blinder in the New York Times. He was convicted only on a sole misdemeanor count for conspiring to violate mine safety rules. Instead of facing up to 30 years in prison, Blankenship will now spend at most a year in jail and pay a $250,000 fine. Many in coal country had hoped for a harsher penalty, said Evan Osnos in TheNewYorker.com. Though Blankenship did not face charges for the actual deaths of the miners, he had for so long embodied a harsh shibboleth of America, of modern Appalachian politics, namely that coal mining is the best job poor people there can expect, and they should be grateful for it. That just seeing him in a courtroom seemed like justice of a kind. Prosecutors spent weeks cataloging Massey's most brazen deceptions, such as informally training workers to skirt safety inspections. But defense attorneys, without calling a single witness, repeatedly sought to distance Blankenship from the firm's worst practices. Prosecuting the CEO of a major company for an industrial accident is highly unusual, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. But then, much about this case was odd, starting with the prosecutor's flimsy evidence and the zeal with which Obama's Justice Department went after Blankenship, who had made many political enemies by spending millions to elect Republicans in West Virginia. There's no denying that the Big Branch accident was a tragedy, but Massey has paid dearly for it, with millions of dollars in penalties and restitution to the victims' families. This was a shameless attempt to spin an accident into a crime. There will be a lot of second-guessing about the case now, said Ken Ward, Jr. in Charleston, West Virginia Gazette. Every lawyer in coal country will have an opinion about what prosecutors could have done better or whether charges should have been brought in the first place. But what ultimately bears examining is why U.S. lawmakers have decided that willfully defying mine safety rules is a misdemeanor and nothing more. Perhaps we should ask ourselves why violations of the law at all are acceptable in an industry where the margin for error is so small and the potential for disaster is so large. We're on the health and science page now. The brain isn't simply male or female. Conventional wisdom holds that men and women's brains are wired very differently. But a detailed new study has found that most brains have a mix of structures associated with traditional male and female traits and behavior, making every person an individual mosaic of gender-related characteristics. Israeli researchers analyzed 1,400 brain scans of 169 men and 112 women between 18 and 79 years old, zeroing in on brain regions whose size and pattern of connections are associated with gender differences such as aggression, empathy, risk tolerance, and spatial ability. They found that no more than 6% of brains were composed of all male or all female structures. More than half of the brain study, however, contained a mix of these structures, indicating that most people fall somewhere along a gender spectrum, with some strengths and tendencies typically considered male and others female. The findings, say the study author Daphna Joel, are consistent with a growing body of research suggesting that gender identity is formed through a complex interaction of genetic, hormonal, experiential, and environmental factors. The idea of a unified masculine or feminine personality turns out not to describe real people, Joel tells LiveScience.com. It describes stereotypes to which we constantly compare ourselves and each other, but more people are gender nonconforming than we generally realize. The health scare of the week, refusing the flu vaccine. Prevailing myths and misconceptions about the seasonal flu vaccine are causing millions of Americans to go unvaccinated, a new survey has found. In a poll of 3,000 adults, researchers found nearly 40% weren't vaccinated and didn't plan on getting a flu shot, increasing their risk of catching the virus and spreading it to others, NPR.com reports. About half of these people felt the flu vaccine is simply unnecessary. Concerns about the possible side effects were an issue for 16% of those polled, and 14% erroneously believed the flu shot could infect them with the virus. People tend to minimize the flu, said epidemiologist Shannon Stokely of the National Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They think, oh, it's like a cold. But it's actually much more serious than that. The flu results in about 200,000 hospitalizations a year and 25,000 deaths. On the Talking Points page, Zuckerberg, Rise of the Hacker Philanthropist. The letter was signed Mom and Dad, said Lindsay McGoy at TheGuardian.com, but it was aimed, of course, at the world. In a public missive to their newborn daughter, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg and his wife, Priscilla Chan, last week announced that they were donating 99% of their Facebook shares, worth $45 billion, to advance human potential and promote equality. Sorry to interrupt all the cheering, said Jesse Eisinger at ProPublica.org, but Zuckerberg did not donate $45 billion to charity. The mega-billionaire created a limited liability company, an investment vehicle that can make political donations, lobby lawmakers, or give money to favored causes and organizations. But Zuckerberg will still control the money and pay no taxes on it until he sells the Facebook stock. So the insanely rich tech wizard has pulled off a massive public relations coup for essentially moving money from one pocket to the other. You cynics seem to be forgetting that Zuckerberg could do anything with his $45 billion, said Matt Rosoff in BusinessInsider.com. He could buy guns or boats or islands. Instead, he and Chan have publicly pledged to spend nearly all of it to fix problems in the world. You have to look really, really hard to find something to criticize here. Granted, not all of their previous charity has been successful, said Jessica Lieber in FastCompany.com. The couple's $100 million gift to the New York, New Jersey school system in 2010 is largely regarded as a failure. But that's the beauty of the latest initiative. He created an LLC intentionally so that he has the freedom to dole out money in a gradual, targeted way, learning by experience what works and what doesn't. That should make for much smarter philanthropy this time around. The problem isn't his intention, said David Auerbach in Slate.com. It's that we're relying on people like the Zuckerbergs to solve our most pressing problems. Silicon Valley philanthropic capitalists like Zuckerberg and Bill Gates seem to believe all the world's ills can be hacked using metrics and money. They and their conservative alter egos, such as the Koch brothers, are moving into a void left by gridlocked government, which lacks the consensus and political will to do anything. In our brave new world, a handful of mega-rich individuals, not our elected leaders, are making the big decisions, while the rest of us have no say over how those billions are spent. And a few shorter notes while we're here on the Talking Points page. The Air Force is running out of bombs and missiles after dropping 20,000 of them in the war against ISIS in Syria and Iraq. It can take years for the Pentagon to contract out for more, so it is frantically shopping for more bombs in other countries. We're expending munitions faster than we can replenish them, said Air Force Chief of Staff General Mark Welsh. Buffalo made it through December 3rd without experiencing any measurable snowfall, the first time that's happened since 1899. Last year, the city had 7 feet of snow by November 22nd. Nearly half of U.S. homes don't have a landline and rely on cell phones instead, according to a new federal report. Only 8% of homes rely entirely on landlines. In the poll watch, 77% of American voters support a law that would ban people on the government's terrorist watch list from purchasing guns, including 76% of Republicans and 83% of Democrats. And we'll finish up with a quote from Rosa Parks. I have learned that when one's mind is made up, this diminishes fear. Knowing what must be done does away with fear. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.